Okay, hello, welcome everyone. My name is Erin Schaefer and I'm the Graduate Assistant at the Women's Center. I'd like to welcome you to our Spring 2012 Women on Wednesday series, Exploring and Making Visible Women's Intersecting Identities. This semester's series on women's intersecting identities will explore the rich layers of women's multiple identities and how these intersections shape their lived experience and perceptions. A few items before we get started. If you could please turn off your cell phones and please stay seated until 12:50 as a courtesy to our speakers. If you could please fill out the evaluation forms, we use your feedback for future programming. Also, please note that a pro-choice information picket will be held on campus February 8th. Check the table in the back for more information. Our opening session today is titled Reproductive Rights, the Continuing Journey to Justice. Our panel will discuss current issues in the reproductive justice realm, including the experience of women of color and what life is like was like before Roe versus Wade. Our panelists today are Charlotte Fisher, Isophine Johnson, and Rita Molestina. Charlotte Fisher is a retired nurse from the St. Cloud community. She graduated from St. Mary's Hospital in Minneapolis with a nursing degree in 1951. Fisher went to work at General Hospital, now Hennepin County Medical Center, on a gynecology floor where she cared for women who had self-induced or illegal abortions. After moving to St. Cloud, she worked at numerous sites, including the Family Planning Center. Isophine Johnson is a nurse practitioner at SDSU Health Services. She is certified as both an adult gynecological and reproductive health nurse practitioner and has over 30 years of experience in a variety of settings, including a large urban hospital in St. Louis, Missouri, the Veterans Administration Medical Center, and the state of Minnesota. Johnson is one of the trailblazers in the nurse practitioner profession who graduated from Meharry Medical College in Nashville, Tennessee. She is a graduate of Webster University in Webster Grove, Missouri, with a degree in nursing. Rita Molestina is the Community Education Program Manager at Planned Parenthood, Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota. After graduating from Occidental College in Los Angeles with a BA in psychology, she returned to her hometown and worked for UC San Francisco New Generation Health Center, providing adolescent and young adult family planning counseling, facilitating comprehensive sexual health educating programming, and assisting the university in research efforts. Molestina entered the School of Social Welfare's Master Program at UC Berkeley, where she specialized in children and family services, as well as a School of Social Work, earning a Pupil Personnel Services credential. After finishing her graduate degree and moving to Minnesota, Molestina returned to the field of reproductive health and justice. At Planned Parenthood, she manages Latino sexual health programs in school and community center environments and will soon join the marketing and outreach team of Planned Parenthood focusing on the St. Cloud area. We are very grateful to have them here with us today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Charlotte Fisher, Isophine Johnson, and Rita Molestina. Okay, so we're basically going to have a facilitated discussion. And our first question for the panelists is, what is your background experience with serving women in need of reproductive health services?
I'd like to correct one thing, too. This isn't on.
I think it might be. If you speak a little closer.
Okay. Yeah. Charlotte Fisher is also a nurse practitioner of many decades. She's more than just a nurse, so she should be recognized for her trailblazing in the field of nurse practitioners as well.
Thank
you. I'm Charlotte Fisher, and I think it's important you know a little bit about me. I was born and raised in St. Cloud. Fact is, the first 5 years of my life I spent on the block where Atwood Memorial now is. My folks had a store here. I think it's important you know that because I was born in 1930, I'm 81 years old, and we only had Catholics and Protestants in St. Cloud at that time. We didn't have any other type of all the kinds of things we talk about now, and I happened to be raised as a Catholic, both my grade school and high school, and then when I went in nursing, I went down to St. Mary's, which was also a Catholic nurses training. And so when I was 21, I graduated, and I went to work at what was then General Hospital. It's now Hennepin County. It was a city hospital. And I got assigned to work on what they called women's medicine and GYN. And all of a sudden, I was faced with young women who were admitted who had had attempted illegal abortions either by themselves or someone else. And I didn't know what this was all about. It had never been discussed with me. I had no clue what really had been happening. But as I listened and cared for these women, and I listened to their stories, I can assure you that they did not just decide to have an abortion one day. They were forced into it, often by their husbands, who says, "I don't want another damn kid. If you don't get rid of it, I'm leaving you." Now, this was in 1951, 1952. It was very different than it is now. They did things to themselves or let things happen to them that I couldn't believe. I remember one woman who had heard that you take a mixture of turpentine, and I can't remember the other things. You were supposed to douche with it. What she did was drank it. She died. The physician who was in charge, actually was a resident, had an array of instruments and things that women would use to attempt to have an abortion. They had what they called slippery elms, which were a piece from an elm tree, and it was cut in a diagonal, and you were to insert that in your vagina, and hopefully it would absorb enough that it would irritate and have you have an abortion. I saw hat pins this long. It was unreal what people did. They took a pop bottle, shook it, and inserted it in their vagina. They did things to themselves that you wouldn't do just because you were on a lark. And I hate to tell you, a lot of those women never did go home. They died.
Just a quick announcement. There's no picture taking and also no recording. Thank you.
Maybe I just need to share a little bit more. So obviously, my Catholic religion was questioned, and I thought, this is not right. I can't believe that God, the loving God, would want this to happen to women. So I thought about it. I came home back to St. Cloud. Remember, we only had Catholics and Protestants then. And they had started a little family planning center. It was over a grocery store. You had to go up a real long flight of stairs, and then there was, I think they had three rooms up there, but you had to walk through them. It wasn't like the family planning center is today, believe me. People picketed, but they were nastier, much nastier than the pickets are today. They would question you when you walked in what you were even walking in for. And the thing that bothered me the most was that their logo was a pregnant stork. Now, we all know storks don't get pregnant, but obviously it was a symbol of a female stork, and it really bothered me. I said, you're condoning what we're trying to not have happen, that the woman is to blame. And I was rewarded in them having a contest, and what came out of it was the present logo, which is the tree.
I came through nursing and nurse practitioning after Roe versus Wade, but I heard a lot of stories from my relatives who were in nursing, and the stories weren't so great, especially for minority women. First of all, they didn't have access to any kind of legal medical procedures that they would call abortions back then, so they had to use the back alleys. And Charlotte was saying, you know, in all my years of working at Hennepin County, I never saw a black person. And I told her that's because they, first of all, didn't trust the medical society, the medical system, because of the history of abuse by the medical profession done towards women. Pap smears were actually studied on black women, regardless of what. They were studied on the East Coast, and that's why you have pap smears today, because of black women's being studied against their wills. And then, of course, you know about the other cases of the Tuskegee experiment. So black folks didn't trust the medical society, so they didn't show up at the hospital. They either made it through those back alley procedures, or they died, and that's just what happened. And even those who could afford it, you had to establish a relationship with a physician. They were the ones who were providing this service. And if you didn't have the means of establishing this connection with the physician in order for them to allow you or to approve the procedure. It just wasn't done. So you didn't see black folks in the hospitals. Mm-hmm. And when you saw them, they were dying or they were dead. Mm-hmm. And I did hear of cases like that. And we did see cases like that even after 1973. And that's so unfortunate. You know, I am a person who works in reproductive health rights. I've never performed an abortion, nor have I participated in anything like that. But I am for women having informed consent for anything that happens to their bodies, okay? It's not my decision to make what they decide. But that is something between them and their medical professional and their higher power of wherever they get their source of energy from. So I do provide means for various forms of contraception. I feel that if women had access to contraceptive health, perhaps they wouldn't need the services of the abortionist. But even that's kind of that's being challenged in some areas. They're connecting that to abortions. And so that's my experience. And I like what I do. I like educating young folks about their bodies. I like letting them know their options, because you should be able to plan your family. And that's what contraceptive health is all about, in my opinion.
My experience in women's reproductive health is more education and social service focused. I started as a crisis counselor for the LA Commission on Assault Against Women, and so I was on their crisis hotline counseling individuals who had recently experienced a sexual assault and going on accompaniments to hospitals for folks who had experienced a sexual assault and wanted a forensic exam. And that experience really helped me to recognize the challenges for both men and women to developing healthy sexualities. And that led me to my so far lifelong career in reproductive health. I then started working for UC, a lot of this was mentioned, but I started working for UC San Francisco at a teen clinic where I did a few different things. My experience there was probably most impacted by my time as a family planning counselor, working one-on-one or with couples sometimes at the clinic, in the clinic setting, where I would counsel folks on all sorts of things, doing pregnancy tests, providing information and education on birth control and STI testing and doing risk assessments and that experience helped me to gain an even greater understanding of the barriers to developing an idea of yourself as a person who can have a healthy sexuality and know how to access services. But it left me with more questions than answers. So questions about how a person can. I thought a lot about when you live in a society that has an unhealthy approach to sexuality, it was clear that an individual is going to be a reflection of that, and I wanted to address that on a different level. Seeing patients one at a time for 15 minutes was not enough for me. There were so many things I would hear during a risk assessment that I wanted to address, and I didn't have the time or the skills to do so. So I went to get some more skills, and I went to school to study social welfare and to understand the social and psychological and biological impacts on an individual's personal development and ability to be a productive and healthy citizen. I wanted more information on how to address family concerns and family communication and resources and gender and education environment. So I specialized in children and family services, and I thought I wanted to be a school social worker, but I realized that in everything that I did during my time in school, it was all connected to reproductive health. When I was a resource counselor at a homeless shelter for my first year's internship, I had run a sexual health 101 for the mothers living at the family homeless shelter a few times, and when I was working at high school as a counselor there, I I run a healthy relationships group for young women, and I can't remember how many times in individual sessions, I can't remember how many times I charted the hormone fluctuations in a menstrual cycle to help explain how birth control works and how pregnancy happens. So I realized that I was always in reproductive health, and so after school I went back to doing that work, and I started to work for Planned Parenthood. The majority of the work that I do with them is focused on Latino services, providing educational programming, a year-long educational program for Latino students at Richfield High, and training them to be paraeducators. And I also do family and adult programming for Latinos there, and supporting parents in understanding how they can best talk about sexuality with their kids in age-appropriate and culturally appropriate, developmentally appropriate ways, and really focusing on parent-child connectedness as well. And I think for many folks, probably all of us as sexual beings, have experiences and ideas about what is best for society and for us all, and have a personal connection with these issues. For me personally, my dad is HIV positive, I think pretty much everyone in my family, every young woman has been pregnant at least once. I think that this is an issue on so many levels that needs to be addressed. I just want to emphasize that this has an individual effect on families and our own interpersonal relationships. And I think it's important in talking about these big picture ideas to make sure we bring it down to the individual level as well, and recognize that legislation and laws and decisions that are made in that way have individual effects on people.
Okay, question number two, and Rita, it sounds like you're going to answer question number two and three together, can you share a story or give examples that demonstrate the importance of reproductive justice for women?
Well, if you look at my gray hair and you realize that my experience was over 60 years ago, I have two sons, and I raised them to the point where they said, yeah, Mom, we know. We understand exactly what you're saying. I told them that if they decided to have sexual relations with a young lady and she became pregnant, not to come back home and complain to me, that they had then made at least a 21-year commitment. And that's one of the things that always concerned me. I hope it's changing, but during my era of growing up, it was boys will be boys. And the girls, obviously, were the people who should have known better and not gotten pregnant. And I firmly believe that you young men are as responsible for any pregnancy that occurs as the young woman who gets pregnant. I'm hoping it's improving. I don't know for sure. It feels like it in some ways, but it's a serious thing. And to be able to say things like, the cliches were, well, they need to sow their wild oats, or maybe you should go and have a hot shower, and some of these kind of innuendos that went on when I was young. That's not where it's at. We all have a responsibility, young men as well as young women. I think I've shared some of my examples. What I find most difficult today is, like I said, I was born and raised in St. Cloud, and I'm back here again. And what I find difficult is that we don't talk about this openly. We talk about it hushed, and then we talk about the fact that in my age group in particular, oh, isn't that terrible? And hopefully I've been able to make some impact, because usually when the conversation comes up, I tell them I'd like to tell them my story. And then I tell them the story about my experience when I was 21 and experienced beautiful young women dying because they didn't have access to decent health care.
Okay. I gave a couple of examples from my perspective and from what I learned. But how many of you have heard of Henrietta Lacks, heard about her sales? Okay. So thanks to Henrietta Lacks, who was a young black mother, married mother, living in Baltimore, Her sales helped to create the HPV vaccine that people are benefiting from today. So I'm going back to that history of how there was a mistrust among African Americans in particular with the medical society. Henrietta had cervical cancer, and she had it for a number of years. She kept going back and forth to Johns Hopkins Medical Center, which, by the way, was started for indigent people in the Baltimore area, and she died. But her sales continue to live on and reproduce. They're called the workhorse sales of medicine. Every aspect of her sales have been used. They've been sold. They've been sent to Russia. They've been blasted out of space. They've created a lot of modern medical technology as a result of this lady's sales. So, and her family never received a dime from the sale of her sales. So anyway, that was just one thing I wanted to add. And also before Roe versus Wade in 1973, you know, I would hate to see us go back to that time, because there were women who became pregnant and they were fired from their jobs just because they were single and pregnant. And that's so unfortunate. You wouldn't want to see that again today. Again, having informed consent to do whatever you think is best for you. And we have that as a result of Wade, Roe versus Wade. And also, you know, I don't know if you ever heard of the so-called maternity homes. Mm-hmm. Women were sent away to live out their pregnancies, and then they returned home without a baby and as if nothing had happened. Or in black folks' cases, they were sent to live with relatives, and the relatives raised the babies as their own. And that went on for years. I know of lots of families, and I'm sure some of you in the audience would know of families, too, that raise the babies of a niece or a daughter even. You know, you had families growing up with their babies in the household thinking that this was a sister, and in fact it was a niece or a nephew. And as I said too, you don't want to go back to the back alley abortions, which led to a lot of deaths. They talked about the number of deaths that resulted from those. And usually it was because of poor sanitation, poor technique, and you know, some folks would even do it in a kitchen. And then there were, of course, Charlotte mentioned married women who were forced to carry out a pregnancy regardless of their health condition, financial condition, or living in an abusive condition in a household like that. And that's kind of where I'm coming from. I think it's important that not just women, but for men too, to have reproductive justice, because you know, it takes two to have a baby, and you're not necessarily in a position to take care of a baby on your own as well as the woman. So I think those reproductive rights are not just limited to females. Guys benefit from it also.
Okay. Do you want to go ahead?
No, you can go ahead and explain the next question.
Question number three is, from your experience, how does race, class, and disability, as examples, impact how women get reproductive health services?
So I hope you all forgive me. When I read through these questions, I had a lot of thoughts going on in my head. So for me, that means I got to write. So I'm going to read a little bit from what I've written in response to this question that they just answered, and then this next one. So, to me, reproductive justice is the recognition that reproductive health is connected to and affected by race, class, and other systems of inequality. So in talking about the importance of reproductive justice, I found myself answering question number three, how these systems of inequality impact how women get reproductive health care services. And so here is my answer to all of that together. If we're talking about reproductive health care services as supporting women in making informed decisions about their sexual lives, including preventing unintended pregnancies or the transmission of STIs, which is what my experience mostly consists of. Of course, inequalities in education and clinic access are key factors that impact how women get reproductive health care services. If someone doesn't know how pregnancy happens, how birth control works, or how STIs are transmitted, why would they seek out reproductive health care services? if someone doesn't have a culturally relevant and affordable clinic in their area, how would they access those services? Comprehensive sexual health education and clinic access continue to be barriers for individuals who represent marginalized and disadvantaged groups. Either the services, education, or resources may not be culturally responsive, or they may be unavailable in those communities. For individuals with more privilege and resources, education and clinic services are much more within their reach. However, my concern runs deeper than these tangible barriers. All of these identities mentioned, being a woman or Latina or Black or being a working or poor class, for example, are all identities on the one hand that are underserved due to the very fact that they occupy fewer positions of power when compared to men, white people, middle and upper class people, and so on. When any group like women is not well represented among decision makers and communities and the greater society, their interests are put in jeopardy. Their needs and what's important to them may not be well considered, understood, and addressed by those in power who make decisions about programs and resources that affect other people's lives. On the other hand, people of these identities also live in a society that puts them in a box. We live among stereotypes, harmful, negative, shaming stereotypes, and belief systems that say who we should be in various situations, how to act in a relationship with an intimate partner, what kind of student to be in school, what career options are open to you, what institutions you can trust, like law enforcement and the government, and who you are supposed to be sexually. These beliefs not only affect how lawmakers, teachers, employers, and healthcare providers see those that they serve and carry weight on the decisions they make for them, but they also affect how individuals see themselves. The way these beliefs affect how women get reproductive health care services began to materialize for me when I first started working at the teen clinic in San Francisco as a family planning counselor. And I met with this one high school student who had come in for a pregnancy test. Before I ran the test, we talked about her thoughts on pregnancy, whether or not she wanted to be pregnant, what her options for birth control were if she was not pregnant, and what her options and resources were if the test was positive and she did indeed turn out to be pregnant. I was a bit shocked to hear her say that she didn't really know if she wanted to be pregnant, but that her partner wanted her to be. I was even more shocked to have at least one teen tell me this nearly every other week for the rest of the time I worked there. First of all, who are all these young men telling young women that they should have their child, that they would be there for their baby mama? That was completely contrary to what I had grown up hearing and knowing about young men and the responsibilities they would take on. But perhaps that is another a topic for another panel. Secondly, and more to my point, I was a bit shocked to hear this young woman and many other young women not have an opinion about their future as mothers. Regardless of what the answer is, either no, I don't think being a mother is right for me right now, or yes, I think this is something I want for my life and something I feel like I have the resources and support to handle. For so many young folks, not to be pulled more one way than the other got me thinking. I began to think about what kind of self-image a person in that situation would hold for themselves. What future does she see for herself? A person can only make decisions based on and hold beliefs based on the information they're surrounded by. And if your environment tells you that people like you don't go to college, people like you can't get a good job, or that you shouldn't plan your long-term future and career here in the United States because you might get deported, I believe that becoming a parent in adolescence may be an unsettled choice in that case. Accessing resources that help you prevent pregnancy is not really a thought in that case, since prevention is not an identified goal. The same goes for accessing services and resources to prevent STIs. If you live in an environment where you're told that only dirty people get STIs, and if what you're doing doesn't seem dirty to you, why would you find yourself to be at risk? Why would you access services? I think that there are ways to address this on a large and small scale. Above all, these issues need to be addressed in policy that transforms living conditions and social relations. Planned Parenthood is working in various states and in Washington at the level of policy, but my work as program manager in the education department is to support adolescents in developing healthy identities. All of our youth programs integrate basic sexual health education with a leadership component. We support youth in conducting community contacts and peer education sessions. Developing the skills necessary to be a resource and a leader in the community is one way to fight against this belief system and the negative stereotypes that on the individual level influence decision in the now that affect the future. Having a safe space to go on a weekly basis, having a group leader hold high expectations for you while providing resources and support, and bonding with peers who come from a similar background are all pieces of the puzzle that strengthen the resilience that is often weakened by the daily experience of racism and poverty, among other things, and other injustices. Through the programming I run, I hope to support individuals in tapping into this strength and envisioning a future with desirable options. Thanks. If you want me to repeat the question that this was all started with, I believe it's, from your experience, how does race, class, and disability, as examples, impact how women get reproductive health care services?
Charlotte, do you want to? Or?
Well, I was just going to comment that Isophine alluded to the fact that it's constantly being challenged. And I know that from the newspapers, I'm not actively involved, but from the newspapers, family planning could be challenged even more than it is financially. And, you know, the thing that people don't realize, and unfortunately I don't think the media talks enough about, is from my understanding, many of the young women in this area, that's their only access to health care, is to go to the Family Planning Center. Now, when I worked there, I know we did other things besides talking about the reproductive choice. And so it's one more way that when you look at class or level of income or race, that they're subtly working against them having even that level of health care, much less being able to access to the real health care that they need, which we need to do yesterday. From my viewpoint, we need to really change our whole health delivery system and access and the cost. But it's just one more area that subtly people who are opposed to abortion are taking reproductive choice, period, away from women as they consistently talk about cutting this the amount of money that they get for funding. I guess it's hard to believe for younger people that it hasn't always been the way you have it now. Believe me, what the experience I'm talking about was only 61 years ago. That's not very long when you look at the scope of life in general. And it's fragile. It's much more fragile than any of you realize. And you really need to think about it. You need to be willing to kind of speak up and help educate people who think it's a given, because it was given and it can be taken away.
Yeah, I thought about that too, Charlotte. I thought perhaps people should lose the right, and then perhaps they can appreciate it. You know, it's like the old saying, you don't miss your water until your well runs dry. Well, a lot of people don't know how life is without Roe, because you've always grown up with it. Perhaps your parents even grew up with it. And abortion will always be an issue. It will be an issue for politicians. It would be an issue for people who don't understand the total ramifications of abortions, good or bad. And it's going to be decided by the states, and that's why it's so important that you look at who you're putting into office, because they're going to try to, you know, circle the law by making state laws that would benefit their constituents. And ultimately, it will end up at the Supreme Court. And it's important that, depending upon what you want, you decide which president you want in office, because they appoint the Supreme Court justices. And that will decide your fate, or decide the fate of reproductive health rights. It's just not about abortions. You're talking about women having access to reproductive health. some laws that are coming down now will prevent some women from even having access to contraception. And that's pretty scary, in my opinion. So you really should think about it. It's more than just about abortions. It's about the right to plan your families, as I said before.
Okay, the final question before we start our question and answer period is, what message do you want to impart to the audience about women's reproductive rights from the past, present, or in the future?
I think Isophine pretty much said it. The people who are elected officials, if you watch the news, are going to form many of the decisions that we think are given right, and believe me, they aren't. They can be taken away, and if you listen to what the discussion is around the country, this is going to become a subtle but big issue, and they're going to keep gnawing at it and chewing at it, and you need to do more really than think about it. You really need to look at becoming active politically. You need to think about who you're going to vote for, and you need to think about how do they stand on the issues that are important to me. And this is one issue to look at. And obviously, it's a red-hot issue that comes up, and everybody gets all excited about it. And unfortunately, we're having experiences where our religion, which should not be part of this whole discussion, is becoming very much a part of this discussion. And too many people are voting for people on that one issue. The other thing that I think you need to think about is if you do choose to have this child, which the pro-life side said you should, they abandon you and they abandon your baby. There's no financial support, no emotional support, no nothing for you. It's, well, if you give that baby up for adoption, well, then things will be better. So you need to think about the whole ramification. It's much more subtle than you realize. There's buzzwords and there's comments that make you think, yeah, I think I agree with that. But you need to look beyond those comments, and you need to look beyond what the behaviors are if this is a concern for you. And I would hate to see you young women back into the situation that I experienced as a new grad at the old General Hospital in Minneapolis, where you were fighting for your life because you had attempted either yourself to have an abortion, or you had allowed somebody who should never have been even able to be close to you to have one.
Okay, I pretty much said what I wanted you to leave with. I just want you to know, though, that decisions are made on a national and state level by wealthy people, or people that are influenced by wealthy people, who really don't have a lot in common with everyday folks on the ground doing what you do. So just think about that. People are getting money poured into different campaigns, and it's coming from the small percentage at the top, and that money is not trickling down to you. So make your own decisions. Be careful about who you vote for, and I don't care what political persuasion you are, but make sure that you understand, as Charlotte said, the full ramification of how you're going to be affected.
Okay. So I agree with everything that was already said as well. But I'm also going to comment a little on the future, because I feel like we've got a lot of work ahead of us still. When I think about reproductive rights and rights in general, I think about the often quoted Martin Luther King statement he made, Martin Luther King Jr., injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And at its foundation, fighting for rights is fighting against injustice. And like I spoke about in my last response, the inequalities that exist in our culture are all related to each other. The reproductive health of women who face multiple oppressions is far poorer than those who have more privilege in their life. And this is why I believe that work towards correcting any injustices work towards reproductive rights and reproductive justice. And I believe that creating alliances across causes and across movements and across organizations is the only way that lasting and fundamental change is going to happen. I think I've spoken a fair amount up here, and so I want to leave you with not my own words, but the words of Audre Lorde. And I feel that this quote brings the big picture stuff down to the reality of the individual struggle for justice. Audre Lorde says, "I was born black and a woman. I'm trying to become the strongest person I can to live the life I've been given and to help effect change towards a livable future for this earth and for my children. As a black, lesbian, feminist, socialist, poet, mother of two, including one boy, and a member of an interracial couple, I usually find myself as part of some group in which the majority defines me as deviant, difficult, inferior, or just plain wrong. From my membership in all these groups, I've learned that oppression and the intolerance of difference comes in all shapes and sizes and colors and sexualities, and that among those of us who share the goals of liberation and a workable future for our children, there can be no hierarchies of oppression."
Okay, with that, we can open it up to questions. Yes.
I can't comment on all of the services that are available, but I can tell you the ones that are being threatened right now in Washington, D.C. 400,000 black women are about to lose their access to reproductive health. That's because of the Congress passing a law that would prevent the district, even though they voted upon this, to have reproductive health insurance, access to it. But the Congress is looking at Washington, D.C. as a foreign country. Because other states are doing it, but because Washington, D.C. is minorities, poor, predominantly poor, they are going to have no care for reproductive health. That's in the pipes right now. That I can tell you that much. So I don't know what he has in store.
Yeah. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, if you look at their comments, to follow up with that, at the same time, they're talking about where they're going to do all the cuts, and they're almost all in human services. So it follows that what he's saying is another falsehood.
And another thing, too, working here at the Student Health Service, I'm seeing more students who are uninsured, and they don't want various tests done. They don't want the treatment because they can't afford it. So we are starting to see a lot of that, even on the local college level, because their parents are no longer working, or their parents no longer have insurance, or their parents cannot afford the insurance that are being offered. So, yeah, it's getting there.
Two things on that. Another service is being threatened, or not service, but a right is being threatened. I think some of you may be familiar with personhood amendments that have been either talked about or going around. And one was voted in Mississippi back in November. It was voted down, so a fertilized egg would not be. Folks wanted a fertilized egg to be considered a person alive, and that would in effect make it so that birth control, like the pill, would be illegal. Because of one of the ways that it prevents pregnancy is by not allowing a fertilized egg to implant in the uterus. Pregnancy is defined as when an egg is implanted in the uterus, not when it's fertilized. So I think it's important to think about what presidential candidates are saying. You brought up Mitt Romney, and he is for personhood amendment. He mentioned that on the Mike Huckabee show on whatever station he's on. So that's of concern. That's going to be threatened, and the vast majority of women in our country at some time in their life have utilized birth control in some form. The other thing I wanted to mention about services that are available is Planned Parenthood is working through a program called For Now to offer free birth control to individuals who qualify economically. So if you can't afford birth control or a clinic visit like that at Planned Parenthood, you can go, and through the For Now program, you can qualify for free birth control.
I wanted to say something too. It was not only Mississippi that came up with laws that would prevent or curtail abortions. Alabama, Louisiana, North Dakota, Ohio, Mississippi, and Oklahoma. And they were all struck down because even the anti-abortion activists thought that they were too extreme. But they have made subtle changes and limits to what can be done when it, in regards to reproductive health. And again, as I mentioned before, you're talking about state level and states that are looking at trying to pick at it little by little. You know, it's like eating an elephant. You take one bite at a time until you consume it all. So. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What is our opinion on the future of reproductive health care services given what's going on in politics and the government right now? Do we view it as positive or negative?
Depends on who's in office.
Well, a lot of it depends on who's elected, but it's happening and you don't realize it till it hits you in the face. And then all of a sudden they say, well, how could that have happened? Well, you need to listen to the conversations that are going on. And again, with the election that's coming on and the people who are involved, if you've been listening to the Republican debates, there's a whole lot more influence by the religious right. And if they become influential, they're going to be able to get a candidate who's maybe kind of iffy to agree because they want to be elected. You know, it's all in the name of being elected and becoming and getting the office that you want. So what you need to do, I think, is it becoming more negative than positive? I think it's becoming more negative. I really do. I don't remember over the years since Roe versus Wade that I have ever heard the amount of very open, I don't agree to this, to the subtleness that's going on. I read an article in Newsweek, and I read that one of Newt Gingrich's main advisors reads the Pope's encyclicals for fun. Now, that frightened me. And it's because, is that what influences his beliefs and so on? We have a country that's supposed to have separation of religion and state. And it's becoming intertwined, if you think about it, very subtly. Religion is doing influencing that technically and legally it needs to almost be looked at, because remember, they get everything tax-free. And so therefore, that means they are not to influence the political arena. And it's something we need to be aware of, and not only just be aware of, but think about, and if possible, say something about to help people understand what's happening. You know, just knowing about it isn't always enough. Sometimes we have to be a risk taker and say, you know, this isn't what our government was founded on. And we constantly hear about the Constitution in all these political discussions, and yet parts of the Constitution, they are not abiding by at all, if you think about it. So it's, from my viewpoint, and maybe I'm being a naysayer, I'm concerned. I have never been in all my life as concerned as I am this year.
And I don't know if this was a part of the question, but following up on what Charlotte said too, I think you need to just not only hear what the politicians are saying, but you also have to observe what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They will say one thing and do another. There's a politician out there now running for president, and he's saying that students should work while they go to school. They should get a part-time job and do this, that, and the other. Well, his father-in-law, his stepfather said he refused to work when he was in school. He said his job was to go to school, and that was all he ever did. So think about it now. You know, they're telling you one thing, but they're doing another. So just look at what they're doing, and if they're not doing what they're saying, then that should frighten you. Okay.
Okay, we'll just 12:50. Let's thank our speakers.